Picture walking into a Chinese factory where the air burns your nostrils with chemical fumes. Your eyes water from the adhesive vapors, the acrid smell of melting plastics, the heat from ceramic kilns. You instinctively cover your nose. But the factory boss? He inhales deeply and smiles. "To me," he says, "this place smells like money." This single moment captures everything about China's manufacturing revolution, a world where Western sensibilities collide with an entirely different calculus of success, where what looks like chaos to outsiders represents opportunity to insiders, and where the products filling American shopping carts emerge from a system that defies every assumption about how business should work. This isn't another dry economics treatise. It's a detective story set in the heart of global manufacturing, revealing why that Made in China label on your shampoo bottle tells a far more complex tale than you ever imagined. After business school, armed with degrees in Chinese history and language, I thought I understood China. I was spectacularly wrong. I became an accidental troubleshooter, the person American importers called when everything had already gone sideways. Like a noir detective, I handled cases in China's industrial underworld, a place my Ivy League education had somehow never mentioned.
We can make anything you want. All we need is your sample. This mantra echoed across South China's manufacturing belt, where nondescript concrete buildings concealed their contents. The barriers seemed wonderfully low. Minimal tooling costs, free assistance, platforms like Alibaba connecting buyers to suppliers. My clients were rarely Fortune 500 giants. They were Bernies and Howards, entrepreneurs chasing affordable manufacturing dreams. Howard's supplier vanished, leading me to Kevin's fortress-like ceramics plant near Chaozhou. Kevin claimed to be from Los Angeles despite never living there. Inside, young workers hand-painted pottery under surveillance cameras. He held their ID cards, hired from different provinces to prevent organizing, and employed industrial spies to photograph competitors' designs. Bernie, an Orthodox Jewish importer, exemplified the typical Western approach. During negotiations at King Chemical, he emphasized his retail connections and Syrian Jewish business network, pressuring for lower prices while painting visions of building one of America's largest health and beauty companies. When Bernie later confessed his ignorance about product formulations, "I'm just the boss," the statement confused them profoundly. No Chinese company president would admit such ignorance. This cultural gap would prove far more significant than anyone realized. The cultural divide was stark. King Chemical workers identified products by codes, many never having used shampoo. They couldn't grasp customer complaints about faulty pumps. You can still unscrew the cap. One Turkish shoe order resulted in nails driven into every left shoe. Workers had replicated the display sample without understanding its purpose. Despite contamination issues, hygiene remained abysmal. Workers carried bottles by inserting fingers inside them. When confronted, Sister promised to stop when you are at the factory. Ultraviolet lights and white coats were theater for visitors. Management resisted removing a worker with infected, peeling hands from gel production. Sister's chilling defense? How is anyone going to find out? Business negotiations extended into karaoke bars with paid hostesses. The next morning, a men's Honda sat abandoned in the hotel parking lot. At the factory, Sister questioned me about the previous night, not like a jealous wife, but someone seeking leverage. In China, everything interconnected and every piece of information became potential currency. Chinese factories perfected quality fade, the incremental degradation of products over time. Our bottles had been quietly made thinner without permission, despite us owning the molds. The factory manipulated quality in small steps until bottles collapsed with slight pressure. Manufacturing became a game where factories hunted for savings while importers raced to discover where corners were being cut. When Bernie tried meeting the bottle supplier, King Chemical provided a decoy company instead, arranging meetings with red herring suppliers. The risk imbalance was extraordinary. Johnson Carter paid full cash up front before shipping, while retailers received credit terms, creating a six-month gap between payment and revenue. If retailers discovered defects, they could stop payment and charge fees for removing products from shelves.
Returning defective goods to China was impractical due to red tape and shipping costs. Chinese factories rarely admitted fault. When they did, they offered discounts on future orders, effectively requiring importers to reward problematic manufacturers with more business to recoup losses. This perverse incentive meant the worse a factory performed, the more business it might receive from desperate importers trying to recover their money. Emperor Qianlong discovered a fake Ming Dynasty jade cup and praised the counterfeiter's skill, commissioning a commemorative box. This cultural appreciation for well-executed fakes persists. Citizens routinely develop skills to detect counterfeit currency. The most insidious practice? Factories recreating a customer's product with identical appearance but inferior materials, then blaming the customer. For the price you were paying, what did you expect? King Chemical's warehouse displayed counterfeit domestic products, Olan mimicking Olay, Rysoft copying Rejoice. Their comfort with imitation extended to Bernie's deodorant stick project. They perfected the casing while the product inside had the consistency of warm butter. This exemplified China's manufacturing philosophy: build from the outside in, creating something that looked marketable before focusing on functionality. Bernie confronted King Chemical about raising prices after he'd confirmed pricing with retailers, a tactic transferring profit margin from importer to manufacturer. The dynamic resembled Chinese fishermen who trained cormorants to catch fish but tied their necks to prevent swallowing. Bernie secured retail contracts only to have King Chemical snatch away his profits. Unlike other industries rewarding customer loyalty, Chinese manufacturers operated a reverse frequent flyer program where relationships deteriorated over time. Sister's new factory, double the size, gleaming with stainless steel, signaled a power shift. During negotiations, she remained stubborn and disinterested, no longer needing Bernie's business. The puzzle of manufacturers claiming poverty while growing wealthy unraveled when I discovered King Chemical secretly shipping empty Johnson Carter bottles elsewhere. Following the trail revealed a makeshift factory producing counterfeit Johnson Carter products for an Australian agent, cutting Bernie out completely. From China's perspective, the world divided into two markets. The first market, the US, Canada, Western Europe, protected intellectual property. The second market comprised economies where IP wasn't enforced. Manufacturers sold to first market importers at cost, while earning entire profits from second market customers paying higher prices. A common practice: accept an order for 500,000 pieces, produce 700,000, and sell the surplus 200,000 at significant markups. With margins on surplus reaching 100 to 200%, factories could price original orders at or below cost. These contraband operations served as crucial profit centers. In China, Guanxi trumped money. Sister proudly displayed photos of her husband meeting Communist Party officials. Some industrialists used manufacturing to obtain inflated property valuations for loans. Others produced at cost to gain product knowledge and customer access. King Chemical's showroom displayed Johnson Carter products as capability examples, attracting buyers with proven designs. Chinese manufacturers no longer needed their first market importers. After years of collaboration, know-how had transferred, and second market importers generated significant revenue. American importers approached business linearly, buying for a dollar to sell for two. Chinese suppliers sold products at cost to reach the customer's customer, make real estate plays, or build government connections. While importers played checkers, manufacturers played chess, thinking multiple moves ahead with strategies Western business people couldn't perceive. As Chinese manufacturers grew wealthier, they exercised more leverage, contrary to American assumptions that prosperity would make China easier to work with. During the Clinton administration, when Congress debated China's most favored nation status, the U.S. missed an opportunity to demand reforms. Politicians and business leaders rushed into interdependency driven by greed without understanding consequences. This premature decision to open trade doors was the one thing related to China that was truly poorly made.
By the time anyone noticed, the game was over. China had won by playing an entirely different game that no one else even knew existed.